Aviv and later with Ivan Galamian at Juilliard in the late 40s. He was a founding member of the LaSalle Quartet, for which he plays first violin. The LaSalle Quartet, of course, has received Grand Prix de Disque for their new Vienna School set and for their recordings of the late Beethoven quartets. Their Zemlinsky set also won numerous prizes. The most recent addition to a prestigious discography for Deutsche Grammophon is a compact disc recording of Luigi Nono's quartet Fragment Stillness, commissioned by the LaSalle Quartet. Mr. Levine has just returned from a 20-city European tour and comes to us today from the University of Cincinnati, where he is also busily engaged in teaching. Very pleased to have Walter Levine with us today.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. The LaSalle Quartet has recorded for Deutsche Grammophon exclusively since 1968. And you might wonder why an American quartet, which started just a few blocks north of here and got its name from the street that crosses Broadway just below 125th Street, why such a quartet records exclusively for a German company. The explanation is simple. Earlier contacts with American companies invariably ended when it came to the discussion of repertoire. They didn't seem to be interested in what we were playing, and we weren't interested in what they wanted us to play. Just as a small example, I was called by a big New York company in the mid-50s, claimed they were interested in getting a young quartet on its roster. And they asked me to come to New York, and I busily packed some of our tapes and what I considered to be a representative number of interesting pieces that we had in our repertoire and reviews and programs. And I flew to New York and came to the office, very impressive office it was. And the gentleman, I unpacked my stuff and eager to show things. And the gentleman said, oh, you don't have to show me anything. We know about you, and we've had very good reports. And anyway, we have certain ideas of our own, and I'm sure you'll be delighted. And the idea was, he said he wanted us to play some Strauss waltzes with a well-known violinist as soloist and maybe adding a bass player to the lot. I was so totally speechless that I didn't know what to say. I just packed up my things and said goodbye, and he was somewhat nonplussed. He thought, well, why, isn't this good enough for you? After all, we have the Budapest. And I said, well, in that case, if you do, why don't you ask them to do it? And thus came to the conclusion, one of several quite similar encounters. On the other hand, DG came to us because of our repertoire and maybe also because of our somewhat non-conformist ideas about interpretation. Now, in the relationship between a record company and the performer, there are two people of prime importance. The artist and repertory man, with whom you handle all your negotiations concerning what you're going to record and what are they going to do for you in return, and the actual producer who supervises the actual recording. Early in our recording relationship with Deutsche Grammophon, these two functions were combined in one person, with whom we did practically all our DG records. That was Rainer Brock. Those of you who might have known Rainer, he did a lot of recording in this country in recent years with the Boston, Chicago Orchestra, particularly with Sergio Zava and Claudio Abbado, will understand that because of him, our recording experience is probably quite untypical. His mixture of sympathy, understanding, sensitivity and thorough musicianship, combined with a sardonic sense of humor, his ability to criticize gently but firmly. Like a great conductor, he got us to try even harder and to like it. Last November, when I was asked to speak here, we were just about to leave for the La Salle Quartet's annual tour of Germany, and at the end of which, just before Christmas, we regularly do our recording. The program included some Bach fugues arranged for quartet by Mozart and the third quartet by Arthur Schnabel, a typical La Salle Brock DG mix. It was Rainer Brock's last recording. He died in January, and we miss him. Rainer liked our nonconformist attitude regarding both repertoire and interpretation. More, he encouraged it and even egged us on. Recording companies tend to be wary of so-called unusual repertory to the point of constantly re-recording the staples. New music, in particular, on the major labels, has long since become a stepchild in constant danger of demise by starvation. But from the very beginning of our relationship to Deutsche Grammophon, we could record a wide gamut of repertory. In addition to some of the standard fare, it included many of the new avant-garde pieces we premiered. Furthermore, the great masterpieces of the Second Viennese School, all the Schoenberg, Berg, and Webern quartets, and later the four quartets of Alexander Zemlinsky. And even some neglected earlier pieces, such as the Hugo Wolf Big D Minor Quartet. Since I will refer several times here to the somewhat non-conformist repertoire of the La Salle Quartet, which is characterized by the list of things we have recorded over almost 20 years for DG, let me just give you an example of what these things consist of. We've, of course, done Beethoven quartets, the album just mentioned of the late quartets. We've done all the Brahmses. We've done the Schubert Quintet with Lynn Harrell. We've done the Schumann Piano Quartet with James Levine, the Hugo Wolf Quartet, and some other staple classical works, Debussy, Ravel. But in addition to that, the DG catalog has these pieces to boast of, which I don't think most of whose can be found in any other catalog. A quartet by Hans-Erich Apostel, a student of Alban Berg. Of course, the entire Schoenberg album of five records with all the five Schoenberg quartets, the two Bergs, and all the Weberns. Quartets by Earl Brown, by John Cage. Quartets by Georgi Ligeti, Witold Lutoslawski, Toshiro Mayuzumi, the Nono just mentioned, the most recent one on CD. The first quartet by Christoph Penderecki, the very first performance, by the way, of any work of Penderecki's in the United States, when we did the first performance of that piece in 1959. Quartets by Wolf Rosenberg, etc. The process of agreeing on the repertory to be recorded results in some fundamental decisions of the greatest consequence in the relationship between the performer and his recording company. More than the performer might at first realize, the artist's future may be molded by the works he records. If the records are successful, he may well be typecast as a specialist for this or that, and forever after engaged in concerts to play these pieces. That's all right if the music is, say, by Beethoven. But what if you have, at the insistence of the company, done the complete works of Dittersdorf, and the recording wins a Grammy? You may as well retire. The 40 to 50 minute LP and now the 70 plus minute CD have totally changed the thinking about the works to be recorded. These sound carriers double up repertory. You need three or four Haydn quartets or Mozart quartets to fill a single CD. Where a long work, say the first Schoenberg quartet, filled a single, if somewhat short, LP, about 40 minutes, DG was reluctant to issue the quartet by Luigi Nono of similar length on CD. They did anyway, in the end. What do you do to couple with a work like that? And what do you do about short pieces? The need to fill time produces strange combinations of pieces, justified by little else than the aggregate duration. This has long since resulted in the complete works syndrome. Record producers love the complete works of almost anybody. That's fine for a lot of lesser or even unknown pieces hitherto ignored on records, and for that matter in the concert hall. And occasionally, really great works have been rediscovered by this process. Zemlinsky, Schoenberg's only teacher and brother-in-law, comes to mind, recently rediscovered with a tremendous boost from recordings, and I would like to add with a tremendous boost from our keynote speaker of this morning in the New Yorker, who wrote a very long and very detailed article on Zemlinsky and propelled a record that might otherwise have gotten by somewhat unnoticed into becoming, lo and behold, one of the 10 most sold records in the United States for 3 weeks in a row. It was on the bestseller list just behind Pavarotti's O Sole Mio. But this appetite for the complete works has a very negative side. If you want to record one quartet, say by Schubert, you can't do that. You have to do them all, or none at all. Now, some performers are encyclopedic by nature. They love to do complete cycles anyway, and for them, this is great. Others like to pick and choose, and we are among the latter. And to those, it poses a dilemma. Thus, for instance, we have never recorded the big Schubert quartets, the G major, the Death of the Maiden, or the A minor, because we didn't feel we wanted to spend years studying all the early Schubert quartets. We've done a fair number. There are 11 early Schubert quartets, and you'd have to spend a major portion of several years working, rehearsing, and playing these pieces to bring them to a point where you would want to record them. And it's simply a matter of priorities. You can't do everything. On the other hand, without being aware of it, we had over the years played most of the quartets of the Second Viennese School, Schoenberg, Berg, and Webern, so that when the Vienna Festival planned its 1968 festival around the works of these composers and asked us to do a complete cycle, we were surprised that we had indeed assembled the closest thing to the complete works we ever did of anybody. And it became our first really big recording project, thanks to Karl Faust and Rainer Brock. Some of the company officials were dubious. It'll never sell. Much too esoteric. But to the consternation of all concerned, it turned out quite otherwise. The five record set became an instant bestseller and won numerous international record awards, including the Grand Prix Mondial. It has remained an active catalog item on the expensive yellow label for over, 16 or 17 years, which is a very long time, as those of you connected with record sales know, for anything to remain in the catalog. I would like to just add one thing to this. It constantly surprises me to what extent those people responsible for deciding upon repertoire fall prey to the same mistaken thinking that only the most conservative middle of the road recording projects can succeed commercially. And the continuing and continuous resistance to being a little venturesome and experimental. Invariably, when we have suggested some new piece to be recorded, there were voices that cautioned that this couldn't possibly succeed. The Zemlinsky Quartet that I just mentioned and was a case in point. Nobody wanted to record Zemlinsky because most people didn't even know who that composer was. They thought he was a relative of Lutoslavsky or somebody like that, and an avant-garde composer and another one of those things that nobody was going to buy. And when the second quartet, in spite of all the negative anticipation, became such a huge success, we were immediately pressured to do all the rest of them. There comes the complete works syndrome again. And it is this, the Germans say, Himmel hoch jauchzend, zu Tode betrübt. Either way up there or way down in the dumps attitude, which we find puzzling. And it so often has been disproved that the interested record buyer will buy a 17th version of The Death and the Maiden rather than the first version of something like the Hugo Wolf D minor quartet. We find that the contrary is true, that intelligent record buyers and those with a large collection tend to buy new things that will add to their enjoyment, that will change their appetite, maybe slightly, but enlarge it. So much for our observations on A and R decisions. Is it necessary to point out the importance of recording, coordinating recording with performed repertory? Recording that which one has worked in depth and performed repeatedly in concert, so that it is really seated in and represents the collective concept of the performer of the piece at the time to the best of his or her ability. For this reason, we always plan our recording sessions at the end of concert tours on which the works to be recorded will have had many performances. Recording companies, strangely enough, tend to ignore this need for slow maturing and put pressure on artists to record a piece which you would have to learn for the first time for the recording. Luckily, we were spared such pressure. In the case of the New Vienna School, we had played most of those works over almost 20 years before we recorded them and performed the entire cycle in Vienna, in Hannover, and in Düsseldorf just prior to the recording. The beginning of a recording of that cycle, which took a period of almost 2 years to complete. That's a long time, and it's taking a long breath for a recording company. They usually like to get things recorded once the contract has been made. They would like to get the recording done the next week, if possible, at most 2 weeks later. Other pieces that we had planned to record, such as the Ligeti Quartet, and also to give the first performance of, we had to postpone because of the difficulty of learning that particular piece by over a year. First performance and recording were postponed. The recording by 2 years, the first performance by 1 year. And similar things have happened. And I must say, it's absolutely phenomenal to which extent Deutsche Grammophon is willing to accommodate that peculiarity of ours that we think one should really know a piece before one records it. The first step in preparing any work for recording is a critical review of the text. This might strike you as strange, but preparing works, old and new, requires research for authentic texts. Manuscripts, composers' own performance scores, etc. And that does not just go for new pieces, it goes for Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert as well, Haydn. Many of the currently used and available editions of these great masterpieces are full of legions of glaring errors. Wrong notes, wrong dynamic, wrong phrasing. In the case of the Schubert works published by Peter's edition, entire parts of phrases cut out because they don't conform to the concept of the eight-measure phrase. An irregular phrase structure is simply eradicated by overzealous editors. And nothing is said about that in these editions. And they are current, and many recordings that you will find on the market are still using very flawed texts, while there are by now, at least in the case of the Mozart quartets and in the case of the Beethoven quartets up to Opus 95, and in the case of the Haydn quartets, a large number of the 83, very authentic and very carefully edited and annotated texts available. Performers don't necessarily use them, and not recording companies either. Our first sessions launched us in typical fashion on a double track. An avant-garde record on the one hand, combining the first Penderecki quartet, the Lutoslavsky, and a piece by Toshiro Mayuzumi. And on the classical side, the Hugo Wolf D minor quartet. These were our first sessions in Berlin, in Germany, and they provided a somewhat sobering experience. We'd done quite a bit of recording for radio stations around Europe, invariably in the very respectable, somewhat antiseptic studios of the West German Radio in Cologne, the Südwestfunk in Baden-Baden, or RIAS in Berlin, Radio France in Paris, or the BBC. I don't know why, but somehow we expected something a bit more glamorous from DGG. What we found in Berlin was a huge abandoned movie studio, really more of an airplane hangar. Maybe that's what it originally was, since it was in Tempelhof, the location of the old Berlin airport. It sported a leaky roof. We actually had to move the quartet occasionally to avoid the dripping water. But Brock and sound engineer Klaus Scheibe were completely unperturbed. Managed deadpan to dispel our initial apprehensions and dismay at this somewhat chaotic mess. And things proceeded surprisingly smoothly. Later recording venues were sometimes better, sometimes not. But we never have recorded for DG in a regular recording studio. They don't do any recordings of anything in a recording studio, and they don't have one. A small hall in the Residenz in Munich, for instance, the Chamber Music Hall in Hannover, a public meeting hall in Winterthur in Switzerland, and in recent years a high school auditorium in Hamburg-Harburg. It is engineer Klaus Scheibe who has the say. The sound of the hall is the only criterion. The intrusion of extraneous noises is a constant threat. In Berlin, the low-flying aircraft approaching nearby Tempelhof Airport, and an occasional direct hit by a raindrop on the microphone. In Munich, the noise of cars being started in the courtyard parking lot of the Residenz. And in Harburg, in the Harburg High School, where we are doing our recordings nowadays, the lusty yells of the kids during class break. Actually, it probably helps to relax everyone. The atmosphere is not as grim as it might be in the operating room atmosphere of the studio. Occasional inadvertent breaks in a recording session, if not too long, so that you lose the atmosphere and the continuity, can provide a welcome safety valve and a chance for a quick orange juice and cookies. Depending on the repertory, there are usually 4 to 5 sessions planned. The first one is concerned primarily with mic placement, balance, and general sound for the work to be recorded. As far as microphones are concerned, DG generally, and Klaus Scheibe in particular, likes to use an absolute bare minimum of microphones. We have constantly are also recording for radio stations around various parts of the world. And we are always amazed, after having gotten used to DGG's use of two mics right above us, and then two pointed into the hall for whatever reverberation they do want to have on the recorded sound. And that is it. The two main mics are only, there are really only two mics that record us directly. When we come to some concerts which are being recorded live by radio stations or do an occasional recording in a radio station studio, we are appalled by a forest of 20 mics for a little measly. We said, well, yeah, we're a string quartet, and in fact, a string quartet are only four, which I sometimes think is not generally realized. Balance and general sound means repeatedly playing of parts, of movements, and trips to the control room for everybody to listen to the results. Now, the general sound of a recording is something hard to put your finger on. It has very much to do with the style in question. Obviously, a large romantic piece with an orchestral sound to it, such as even the Brahms Quartet or the First Schoenberg or the Hohe Wolf, will require more ambiance, a little more reverberation than will a Bach fugue, in which you want to have absolute clarity of line and a minimum of reverberation. And then again, a French piece such as the Debussy requires a certain perfume, a certain feeling for sound that's very different again. And this is something that sometimes one has to experiment with. It's almost impossible to put your fingers. On the whole, we tend to dislike too much reverberation. The sound that we like is a clear sound in which you can hear everything. And luckily, in that respect, we have had no quarrels whatsoever with our team, ever. It's been absolutely easy. And nowadays, to set up, make the setup for a recording requires very, very little time. Actually, sometimes only minutes. Thus, we have, in recent years, tried to shorten this procedure and start actual recording already at the first sessions, where in former years we used to spend the entire first session just with microphone placement and getting the right sound. And then starts the recording itself. We like complete takes. We make believe we are playing a concert. We are used to playing concerts. And therefore, for us, the best thing to do is to play as if we were playing a concert and record complete movements. Usually, Rainer wants three complete takes of each movement to choose from. Then, if he feels that there are some dubious places not satisfactorily covered in any of the complete takes, we will make specific corrections to be inserted into a complete take of choice. There's no telling how much you will get done in a session of 2 to 3 hours. We don't record much longer than that for reasons of concentration. Other people are much less fussy in that respect and record for 7 and 8 hours till everybody sort of falls dead on their face. Usually a major quartet of, say, 30 to 35 minutes will take us 2 separate days of session, sometimes less. We find that when we know there is plenty of time scheduled, things go very fast. When time is short, nothing works and it takes forever. Some time, of course, is used up by tuning. We tune very carefully to a 440A on an electric quartz metronome. This is essential if different takes are to be later combined. However, DG's claim to possess a tape on which we supposedly tune for 45 minutes nonstop should be relegated to the realm of fantasy and myth. By the way, that we tune to 440 is by no means self-understood. It's a very conservative trait of the LaSalle Quartet. 440 by now is bottom A, for anybody in the Western performing hemisphere, Vienna uses an A in excess of 446, and most orchestras are way above 440, have already been for quite a while, and for convenience sake, most instrumental groups have followed suit. Pianos are usually tuned quite a bit higher than 440, and when you insist on a piano being tuned, if you play with a piano and record with one, you have to let the organization know several days ahead of time, because the pianos have to be tuned down, and that creates major havoc, and they go out of tune again rather rapidly if it's a major change. And we had great trouble when last summer we played. During the actual recording, contact between the recording team and the quartet is maintained by a small speaker placed close to us through which they speak to us. We, of course, are heard by them through the recording mics. In addition, a video camera is trained on us, I guess, to provide visual confirmation if the sounds that they are hearing are really being produced by us and not by a technical malfunction. The team rarely interrupts our playing, and then only if there's some disturbing noise, either from extraneous sources or somebody's chair squeaking. After we've finished, there is usually a pregnant moment of silence. Then a voice from the speaker might ask, "Are you in a great hurry today? That was just the first take, and it already sounded like the third." That means Rainer liked it. Otherwise, it might be, "I suppose you're warmed up now. Would you like us to start recording?" We used to spend much time listening back to the day's work together with the team, but long ago we found that we could rely on Rainer Bock to select the best takes without our help and let him prepare an initial complete version. A process that usually takes a few months. It is still a very exciting moment when one first hears the results of all the detailed work of months, in fact, years ago. And usually there are a few places that need further correction, hopefully available from the different takes. Very rarely there is no really satisfactory solution. Some place or passage needs to be re-recorded. I once discovered after a recording that I had misread a harmonic, always played a totally wrong note. The passage was redone 6 months later in Paris, where the original recording had been done in Harburg, and it is virtually impossible to detect that fact. A second corrected version is usually okay, and the production of the final record can start. In this part of the process, we are involved with the inevitable round of photographic sessions to produce another timeless cover picture masterpiece, an activity roundly despised by all concerned, and more importantly, participating in the production of liner notes for the record. This we like to do and think very important. It's a vital link between the artist, the music, and the listener to his record is often left to professional program note writers who may know little about the performer's particular viewpoint and insights gained in years of intimate contact with a particular work. We try to collaborate with them, producing what we think can be a substantive supplement to the inquisitive listener. An example of such collaboration is the book that accompanied the initial pressing of the second Viennese School album. It is a collection of original documents, letters, analyses by the three composers pertaining to the works in the album. This book was issued in German, English, and French and has become a standard reference tool for anyone working on Schoenberg, Berg, and Webern. It's since also been translated into Japanese. If any one of you has that album and didn't get the book because it was only in the first print issue of that set, we still have a few copies, and if someone would like to get one, I'll see what we can do. We have some in German, and we also have some in English. I had hoped to have enough time to, in case there were some questions of yours. I think I have 3 minutes, do I, or so? Or is it time to end?
Let's do 2 questions.
All right. Are there any questions? Yes.
You mentioned a control room, but at the same time you said you were doing these remote
No, it's just that the control room, for instance, in the Residenz in Munich, is almost in a different part of the building. It takes about 10 minutes to walk there, and they have no visual contact with you. The DGG in Munich, in the Residenz, where they've done a lot of recording, has its own recording room, where they always have their fixed equipment in. And we record in the Plenarsaal of the Residenz, which is way, way on a different floor, and you've got to go elevators up, down, corridors, and so forth. And it's a real nuisance. And they can't see you, and you couldn't hear them unless there was a... And it's almost always that way. The recording facilities are in a remote place, and they can't see us unless they have a video camera, and we can't hear them unless they have a speaker there. Yes?
Have you or do you ever modify your interpretation of the piece solely for the recording session as opposed to concerts?
No, we don't. We consider... I mean, we cannot possibly conceive of the idea of recording something for the sake of a record differently from the way we hear and think about the piece. We make absolutely no changes, and we refuse to adjust our playing. We insist that the mics are placed so that we do not have to make, and we also refuse to change our seating. We will not have the cellist move a little more out this way and the first violinist face this. We are used to playing quartets in a concert situation. We must visually have the contact that we are used to. Otherwise, it's absolutely hopeless. Thank God we are never asked to do that. Okay, thank you very much.